Oh, snap. We are here. We are here. We are back. This is the Most High Show. I am your host, Mr. Christian Jansen, Reverend Christian Jansen. Some might call me uncle or dad or son of a bitch. That might happen. It has happened. And worse names have been out there. But today, it ain't about me. Today, it's about what my brother David calls the seat of service. We have Michelle sitting in the seat of service here to share her story. We have Leslie here. She's going to be talking with me a little bit about the recovery rundown. We're going to cover this law that was enacted years ago called the Good Samaritan Act. And all that's happening. It's all happening here on the Most High Show. Check it out.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
Okay, so every week we're talking about the opioid crisis, or something to do with recovery news and information. So we have been producing this show called The Recovery Rundown. And today we're going to play a clip from that show where James and Melinda are talking about this law called the Good Samaritan Law. So check it out, and then me and Leslie will be back to break it down.
The Samaritan Act is a law which protects any volunteer giving aid to an injured person in an emergency situation. It offers legal protection in the forms of exemptions from lawsuits and liability. It basically keeps you from getting sued or arrested for helping someone in trouble. The law is in place so that bystanders do not feel reluctant to help out because of the risk of litigation later. The aim of the Good Samaritan Law is to allow a person to intervene in a time of need and help another person in an emergency situation. It states that if the victim is unconscious or cannot respond, a person who finds themselves as a witness to the incident or emergency can step in and help on grounds of implied consent.
Another objective of the Good Samaritan Act is to help in the rise of the opioid crisis. As drug overdose was on the rise and the most common cause was the opioid overdose, Good Samaritan laws were implemented as a means of reducing the number of overdoses by encouraging victims, friends, and family to seek emergency help, calling 911 knowing that full immunity was guaranteed. All 50 states have some kind of Good Samaritan protection.
The CDC predicts about 90,000 people in America will die from opioid overdoses this year. So this is important information should you ever find yourself needing to administer aid to someone who is in a critical state, particularly from an overdose.
All right, so Leslie is joining me in studio.
Day.
Hey.
Hi.
What's up? How you doing?
Doing great.
Yeah?
How about you?
I'm wonderful. So you ready to talk about this?
I guess, yeah.
You guess?
Let's do it. Mm-hmm.
You were telling our guests before the show that you don't like being on camera. Why is that?
I'm just camera shy.
Why?
I just don't like to be on camera. I just don't. Mm. Yeah.
You just don't. How does that make you feel?
To be on the camera?
Yeah.
Being forced here?
Yeah. Being strong-armed.
I feel like God's with me, that I can do this.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hopefully God's with the people who are in the situation where this Good Samaritan Act has to, or Good Samaritan Law has to come into play.
Yeah.
So you've heard the clip. You've listened to the information.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think that it's great. I was thinking before, like, I guess what happened when it comes to recovery, right, or when it comes to someone dealing with addiction, but then also in that situation where they're in trouble, like
overdosing.
They're overdosing, or yeah. And someone, bystanders are there. And I'm thinking, like, oh, I guess before they used to get in trouble, or they would get charged because they were involved in the whole situation. And so the Good Samaritan Law is great for the ones, so because they don't have that fear of calling for help. if someone was struggling or overdosing.
Right.
Right. And I think about like teenagers, you know, who are partying down in the basement or wherever, right? And they see someone who is not responding, and whatever they took, they don't know if they took anything, and not to fear to call for help. And I think that, you know, that reduces the stigma too of, you know, calling for help, and also what drugs do, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That was a very good breakdown. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. God's definitely with you on this one.
Yeah.
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 So from the way that when I was listening to the clip, the way it seemed like is the Good Samaritan law is like twofold. And that was something I didn't really understand until, you know, the recovery rundown broke that down, right? That that the law is also there for if you're a witness to something happening to somebody and you mm-hmm. put some sort of you intervene in that person, no matter what the cause of their illness or whatever's taking them down or whatever, that you can't be held liable, right? Because I guess someone could sue another person, right?
Right, right.
And so the reason why it's so important now is because the rate of all the overdoses, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we talked about this last week with the Narcan project, and while we're trying to get Narcan into the streets, like where the users are, right, where the active users are,
right,
instead of distributing it to just sober livings or just rehabs or only hospitals or only law enforcement, although they need them, right, our goal is to get it into the streets, into the trap houses, so that if someone's overdosing in that situation, they can put the Narcan on them and then call 911.
So why would it be so hard to do that? Is it because they need training? Or why is it so hard to get a Narcan? And because you think it's good because it's saving lives, right? But why is it so hard to put it out there?
I don't really know.
Drugs is out there, like, you know.
I don't know. I mean, like I said last week, we didn't have a hard time getting it in Philadelphia when we did this project. We're having a hard time in Texas and in Georgia. Now, what I do know is Texas doesn't have a Good Samaritan law.
Mm.
So in a Texas situation, it's a little bit different. But with the Narcan nasal spray, which is the one that we're trying to distribute, it's very non-invasive. So if somebody's passed out from, say, alcohol overdose
mm-hmm.
or some other kind of overdose, the Narcan nasal spray doesn't interfere or interrupt or cause any issues.
You can
spray that into somebody's nose and it won't cause issue, unless if they were overdose from opioid, then it's going to stop that overdose from happening.
It stops
it right in its track.
Right. And then do they go to the hospital right away?
Ideally, but sometimes they won't. They refuse to go to the hospital.
Right.
Yeah, because they want to stay out in them streets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like if someone was saving someone in the street and they put the Narcan.
Which happened in Philadelphia.
Right. Oh, it happened.
In Philadelphia, right. Put the Narcan on somebody.
Yeah.
Two times, two doses on them, which is like four sprays. He finally came through, and then when the ambulance came, he refused to get the help.
My heart. My gosh.
Yeah. But he has a chance to recover.
Right.
So that's why the Good Samaritan law is so important in conjunction with this opioid epidemic, because it means that by educating people that, like, if you're in that situation, you know, you don't have to just leave and call 911. You can stay with the person.
Right.
Who's overdosed, make sure the EMT gets there and make sure they get the medical care that they need. And you're not going to be held liable for anything that happened in that situation. Unless you're sitting on, you know, a lot of dope or guns or.
Or intending to sell those, right?
Right.
I mean, I think they would get in trouble by that.
Yeah. But
yeah. So.
Good breakdown.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So every week we're talking about some kind of recovery news and related information. And so when we come back from a little break, some little Most High break, a little Most High moment, then we're going to come back with Michelle, and she's going to share her story as she sits in the seat of service. We'll be back.
Why Most High Media? Because I don't have the answers. Other people do. And learning from the experiences, the stories, the perspectives, seeing people who've been through the darkest of circumstances and then have come out of it on the other side and have lived extremely exciting, fulfilling lives and tapped into a way of being and a way of living, but it's actually real and obtainable. That's why.
We packed up to tell the story of a young lady who lost her daughter.
So there's a extremely high correlation between suicide, mental illness, and substance abuse.
Come on the ground. Come on the ground. Sir.
I think as of this year, there's about 14 million people in America who have a co-occurring disorder, and a little more than 7% of them seek help for it.
You know, in my addiction, I felt like I was better off dead.
I'm here to talk about my daughter, Megan, who committed suicide when she was 28.
There's enough hope in the people that do recover to where I keep going and keep showing up at places where I'm needed.
If you need some things like love and change, I'm not talking coins and things or diamond rings. Everybody wants some change, but don't nobody want to do nothing till the pain they can't stomach. And they told me that I believed them, so I gave them to the everybody thought that I was tripping, saying that I'm be acting different.
Ain't no high like the most high. Ain't no high like the most high. Ain't no high like the most high. Ain't no high.
Ain't no high like the most high.
All right. And we're back. We're back with the Most High Show. It's so cool. It feels like a real show. We're going to commercials and we're coming back. We got guests. It's a beautiful thing. So today, continuing on this beautiful thing, is Michelle, someone who we met through Instagram. And we put out there that we were looking for people to come share a story. And Instagram has provided a host of community, just grown our community. And we've met so many amazing people. And she was someone who was willing to come on and share her story of recovery, what happened, what it was like, and what life's like now. So if you can, let's give a round of applause for Michelle for joining us today.
Thank you guys so much for having me today. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So Michelle, tell me a little bit about what life is like today for you. What's a day in the life of Michelle like?
A day in the life of me. Well, for me, you know, just recently, I just moved back to San Antonio, Texas, which is where I was born. And honestly, I never thought that I'd be able to be sober here in this city. But I just recently moved back from Austin and I was there for 2.5 years. That's where I went to go get sober. I went to rehab, stayed in sober living for quite some time. And I never really trusted myself. But now I never trusted myself to stay sober alone, if that makes any sense. But now I just got a 2-bedroom apartment and I'm living by myself for the first time since I was probably 18 years old. So for me, the way that I start off my day is just like with gratitude. Before I even open my eyes, I make a decision to start with gratitude. I pray to God, I surrender to Him and I ask Him what He would have me be to direct my thinking. I say certain prayers and I meditate. I guess the biggest change in my life today is that I put God first rather than when I was in my addiction, it was all about me.
Yeah. Okay. So you spent 2.5 years in treatment and sober living before deciding to come home to your hometown.
Correct. Okay. Yeah.
All right. And so tell me a little bit about this sobriety playbook and what you're doing with that online before we get to your story.
You know, I feel like it's something that God wants me to do. I was talking to Leslie right before we started the show, and I was saying, you know, for myself, I did not want to start this channel because I've always been somebody that was just very scared to be on camera and to speak and to talk about my experience. And I had a lot of self-doubt, and I wondered, what could I share on a YouTube channel about my sobriety that would actually help other people? But when I started to pray and meditate, and God was just like, you know, I've just brought you through so much. You were an active alcoholism and addiction for 25 years. You lost the trust of your family. You had no friends. You were homeless. You were a drug dealer. Your life was a living hell. And I literally like pulled you out from the depths of hell. And now you're a testimony to how powerful I truly am. Mm. So I put my own ego aside and decided, you know what? I'm just going to listen to what God is telling me to do. Trust him entirely. Surrender. And so the purpose of my channel is just to not shed a light on me, but to tell people that if you learn to surrender to God, he can do anything through you.
Yeah. Yeah. And that can be very helpful to anybody, right? I mean, not just addicts and alcoholics, right? The concept of surrendering to God and living a principled life in that way, and also surrendering to whatever it is in a very real and authentic way, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Being true and authentic and humble, it takes a lot to get to that place in life, but it's such a helpful place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, it wasn't always like that. Waking up in gratitude, deciding to be grateful, right? So let's go back. And what I'd like to know is, when was the first time that drugs or alcohol, that you realized that it was a solution to a problem for you? When was it the first time where you were like, oh, this is something more than just partying, more than just hanging out with friends. This is something, this means more to me than it does to everybody else.
Yeah, I would say that probably was whenever I went into my freshman year of college. Because prior to that, it was partying, just having a good time. But I realized that it was something that I was relying on to get through my daily life. And it was the solution. It was the answer for me.
Yeah. So freshman year. So what's that like? I mean, are you keeping up with grades? I mean, take me back to that time. Yeah.
Yeah. That was so, so long ago. And for me, when I think about it now, it's like, I was a really frustrated and angry woman at that time in my life. I went to private school from the time that I was a kid until I graduated high school. And when I graduated high school and I was going into college, I made a decision that I did not want to have anything to do with God. And I wanted to live my life the way that I wanted to. And I did not want to be an athlete anymore, which was big time for me. And I wasn't going to do what my parents said because I felt like I was constantly being controlled up into that point in my life. So when I went into college, I went to class sometimes. I had like a 2.5 GPA. Instead of going to most of my classes, I would go party. And I was just in a big time rebellious mode.
Yeah. So you were through high school, you were in sports. What sports did you play?
Oh yeah. Sports. I did volleyball and basketball.
Okay. So that's like, you know, you got practice, you have games.
Yes.
Very regimented.
Two a days.
Yeah. Did that being a part of sports, because I know for me, it was really helpful to keep me out of trouble. Did it help you stay out of trouble during high school?
You know, it did. I feel like if I would not have been in sports, I would have hit rock bottom a lot quicker. Because it did give me a routine. And even though I was into drugs, like I still wanted to be part of the sports thing. So it did keep me like in a not horribly destructive place. I mean, it was helpful.
Yeah. Okay. So it was helpful in keeping you, like, I guess, keeping some kind of a rope or a leash to, for you to wild out completely. So when you first get this taste of freedom in college, you take it to the extreme.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Took it to the extreme big time.
Okay.
So, yeah.
From college, I mean, how long does that last? Tell me, let's get into it.
Okay. So I went to college my freshman year. I went for a semester. I lost my scholarship and I decided to move to California because I wanted to be an actress and a model. And so I went and started living that life, and things got really crazy, really, really quickly. And I would constantly be partying and doing drugs, drinking. I was still underage. LA is just a party city, and everybody that I was friends with was in college, and everyone was just always partying, drinking, or doing drugs.
Yeah. Where in LA were you?
Well, I was in Valencia for a little while, and then Santa Monica, North Hollywood. I moved around to quite a bit. Yeah.
So you moved from Texas to LA to be an actress and a model, and you got wrapped up into the party scene.
Yeah, I did get really wrapped up into the party scene, but it wasn't as bad as it was like whenever I decided to come back to San Antonio. That's when things really took a turn for the worst.
Okay. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So my dad needed some help taking care of my grandparents. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and move back to San Antonio for a little while. I ended up never moving back to California. And the day that I moved back, it was September 11th. And I went, I don't know. I've always been like somebody that's highly empathic, and seeing all of the terror on the television, it was something that was really hard for me to handle. That same day, I met somebody that ended up being my boyfriend that was a drug dealer. And so I started doing a lot of cocaine over the next couple of months. I started to do crack. Now, that was something that I had never experienced. I had never felt so pulled in by something. Like I literally had no choice as to whether I was going to smoke or not. And everything just got really bad.
Yeah. So it got really bad. So I don't want you to share anything you're not comfortable with, but tell me about what really bad is.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like my parents, they didn't want me to come around the house. They didn't trust me. I started selling drugs with him, which is something like I never thought that I would ever do. But then I started to steal a lot. And my parents, they taught me really well growing up, like don't steal, like all this stuff. They're really good parents. But for me, whenever I had that drug inside of me, like it didn't matter. I went against all of my morals. So I would steal from people. I would manipulate people, lie to them. If I couldn't get anything from you, if you didn't have something that I could benefit from, like I didn't want to have anything to do with you. So I was constantly just being really manipulative, treating people really badly, doing whatever it is that I needed to do to get my next fix, because I felt like my world was falling apart if I didn't have it.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, that's the thing with the disease of addiction, right? And it changes the brain chemistry to where you're equating, and especially with something like crack, right? You're equating getting high to food, water, sleep, sex, like the most the human things that we need to exist and survive as a species. The brain wiring changes, and so it's all of us did that, right? And that's part of what the disease is, right? It takes us to that place where we're doing all these things because we think we're equating it to what it would be to get some food or water,
right?
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
So you come back and you get introduced to crack, and that, like, you know, fast tracks your addiction deeper and darker, right? It turns much darker. Mm-hmm. So then what happens?
Yeah. So I stayed with this particular guy for like 7 years. And one thing that I noticed whenever I look back at my addiction is I did certain drugs for like a period of time. For like 7 years, I did crack, and I would stay with the guy for like 7 years. After I broke up with him, I started to work at a really, really good job in a litigation department, and met people that had a lot of money, and so did I. And they were partying by going out to bars right after work every single day. But in addition to that, there was like a lot of pills that people were taking. So,
when you left this boyfriend,
yeah,
you just stopped using crack.
Yeah. Like, okay. I started to drink and then take pills, and it's just like, I just substituted it.
Okay.
All right. Just completely substituted it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I would smoke crack like every once in a while, but I started to do cocaine again and pills and a lot of drinking.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. But you're working around other professionals. So this is kind of that working hard, playing hard kind of mm-hmm. environment, right?
Yeah, it really was. You know, I would really work hard, as hard as I possibly could for the longest time. And, you know, I would take like my little skirt, like my little outfit and all the things that I was going to, I would take my outfit with me so that right after work, I would change, put on my heels, put on my dress, and then go party and then stay up until like 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. And then just kind of like do everything all over again. I mean, it got really bad, like at work, to where I couldn't even show up for work, because my calls would get monitored and recorded, and I would be slurring or really amped up or something. And they knew something was up, but they didn't know exactly what it was. And so I started to manipulate like the system where you would get FMLA paperwork done. Like, I would tell the doctors all this stuff is wrong with me, and they'd fill out all this paperwork, and I'd get paid to work. And I'm paid to not be at work, even though, right. Anyway, it was it was just ugly.
Yeah.
So, and it's just constantly having to keep up with those lies.
Yeah. So how long does that last where you're working and doing that? What happens that keeps propelling your story forward?
What happened is eventually I started to snort heroin, and you know, I thought coke was bad, and then I thought crack was bad. Well, once I got into snorting heroin, that was a game changer. I mean, that was an addiction like I had never even felt before. But you know, I was addicted to pain pills prior to that, Xanax prior to that. And then when I found out that opiates and heroin were like kind of the same thing, but the doctors stopped prescribing the prescription pain meds after several years.
Yeah.
I was told by people that I was buying the pills from, like, hey, it's just less expensive if you just buy heroin. Why don't you just try that? And so I was just so financially in need. I just really needed the drugs, but I didn't have enough money.
Yeah.
So I decided to try heroin.
Yeah. So you're kind of like mm-hmm. leveling up this escape.
Yeah.
Up the change of mind, the change of spiritual state, mm-hmm. like to the point where you get to where you're snorting heroin, just to continue to change your mind and to change reality, right?
Right, exactly. And not only that, it just got to the point where the drugs that were getting me high previously, they just stopped working. My tolerance just went up and went up. And what I noticed is when I would switch from coke to crack, I would be able to get a high. If I went from crack to like pills, then I'd feel high. But if I would have just stayed doing crack for a long time, I kind of stopped having that high feeling.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're like an equal opportunity user. Whatever.
Yeah. I didn't care.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some people call us, is it trash can junkies?
Okay. Yeah. 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 That's a better term. Yeah. So when you get into heroin, and are you still working at that point in time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was. I mean, well, when I say working, I was on FMLA.
Yeah, right.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So I was always at home.
Yeah. Okay, so now we kind of like started the story in freshman year of high school, which is when you really started ramping up. And mm-hmm. when I've done these interviews and every time I've heard a story shared, there's always kind of this thing that we knew about ourselves at a younger mm-hmm. age, right? Mm-hmm. Even before we knew how to escape. Do mm-hmm. you remember that? Does that resonate with you as well?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. What I think about when you say that is even prior to doing drugs, of course, like, I always had felt out of place. I was super empathic. So when I was around other people, I would get really confused because people would be saying things to me and the words coming out of their mouth were completely contradicting to the energy that I was feeling from them. And so I would get really confused because I didn't understand why people were constantly lying to me all the time. So I felt really uncomfortable with that. And not only that, just like if someone was going through physical pain or emotional pain, like I could feel it within my own body. Sometimes I couldn't differentiate from if it's being something that I'm going through that's painful or them.
Right.
And I always wanted to fit in as well. And I noticed that when I was doing all of these good things, you know, if I was on the honor roll, if I was, doing all these sports and stuff, like I wasn't getting a lot of attention, but what I noticed is that when people were doing kind of like negative stuff, that they would get a lot of attention too. So I just, not consciously, but now looking back at it, like I decided to go down the other road because I didn't feel like I was being heard. Mm. And not only that, like I just wanted to dampen the feelings that I was feeling from other people's emotions and physical pain. Like it was just unbearable to me in so many ways that I just wanted to go into a hole kind of.
Yeah.
And doing drugs just completely shut off that part where I could feel anything.
Yeah. Do you remember when this ability to sense, this empathic ability to kind of feel what other people were feeling or to feel other people's pain, do you remember when that started for you?
As far as I can remember, from my first memories as a really, really young kid, I've always been that way.
Yeah. And is that something you still have?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And the thing is that I used to think that it was a curse. Mm. But now I realize how much of a gift it is if I just choose to change my perspective and stop relying on myself for trying to understand these things and really rely and align with God. And he helps me through that.
Yeah. So we're going to get into a little bit of that and we're going to get into the turning point of your story. We're going to take a quick break, run a little promo for the Montana Society, which is a cool show. I don't know if you watched it yet. And then we'll be back.
Montana Society, an inspiring docu-series about a group of addicts who endeavor to repurpose an underground nuclear bunker in Paradise Valley, Montana. Along the way, they learn to work together under the wild leadership of Dean, a financial guru and outdoorsman who has his money on the line. In the end, will they learn to repurpose their pain and the bunker into something new and wonderful? Find out on this season of the Montana Society.
All right. So we're back with Michelle. But I gotta like, what? You're shaking your hands over there, Jeff. My producer's over here. So listen, Montana Society, new episodes every Friday, starting end of January to April 1st, 2022, because I don't know when you're listening to this podcast. You might be listening to it in the future. It's a show about four addicts who go to Montana to renovate an underground bunker. Check it out. But right now, we're talking to Michelle. When we left off, she was talking about this empathic ability that she felt early on and how that's still present in your life. But now, you said that when you were using drugs and alcohol, that ability, that what you thought was a curse, but that gift was turned off.
Yeah, it was shut off.
Yeah,
for sure.
And was that from the moment you started using and drinking, even if you weren't doing it addictively and alcoholically, or was it until you really got heavy into it?
No, it was from as soon as I started. That was one of the reasons why I continued to use from the time I was 14 to 39, was because whenever the first time I smoked marijuana, I just felt like I could breathe. Like I couldn't hear like all the other things that were going off in my life. It's kind of hard to describe, but yeah, I just, I felt like the switch was turned off and on my gifts.
Yeah.
So
I think I understand what you mean. I think, you know, a lot of people have that ability, you know, but sometimes, you know, we use the word like spiritual, right? We kind of overuse it. And to me, like, spiritual is just something we can't really put our finger on. It's something we can't quite explain completely, you know? And so when I say it, it's a spiritual thing, that's what I mean by it's this thing that's beyond, it's metaphysical, right? It's beyond the stuff that I can touch and feel, and I'm sensing it in a different level, right? And so
yeah.
I think a lot of people have that, and a lot of people might equate that and think, well, they're anxious. Or, you know, they're hyperactive or they're depressed, and maybe there are some other things that are going on. So
right.
When did you begin to explore, or before we get into that, because that's obviously I'm interested in the empathy, but before we get into that, you're using heroin, you're on FMLA, you're working the system, you're working the angles, how you can get by and get high. When does it fall apart and you turn to attempt at getting sober?
Well, I guess I just want to go to the point in the story where I was snorting heroin, and then the new person that I was with, my new boyfriend, he started to shoot up. And I was so codependent that I told him this. I said, I don't want you to shoot up without me. I don't want you to do this alone. But when I look back at that, what I was truly saying was, I really want to shoot up. Mm. And you better not do it without me.
Right.
So I started to shoot up for another 7 years, started to do a bunch of pills, drink, and all this stuff. It got really, really bad when I ended up going to rehab. That time I was going to California for rehab. And when I got on the flight and got to the ER, I had an abscess on my left arm, and they almost had to cut off my left arm. So that was kind of like the tipping point for me. Like the first tipping point, I guess you would say. And I started going to a bunch of rehabs and everything like that. I came back home. I said I would never shoot up again. I didn't do it for quite some time. But then I started snorting heroin again and got really addicted really quickly. And the next guy that I was with was a meth addict and said, we're going to get you off heroin by smoking meth.
Yeah.
And the first time that I smoked that, I had never felt so much euphoria and such an incredible high that I got addicted like that. And everything that I had in my life up to that point went away in the matter of a month.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting is the guest we had on last week, same situation, went to the hospital, left arm, abscess, was going to lose the arm. And that was, yeah. Now you went to 12 treatment centers, right?
Yes.
So at what number treatment center is this? Like when you get out and you get into meth, like what number is that? Do you know? Can you remember?
I'm not exactly sure, but somewhere between like 2 and 4 or something like that. Yes. It wasn't my first. It wasn't the last.
So let me ask you, when you're going into treatment during those first 4 times, I mean, are you apprehensive about the process, or are you really trying? Like, what's your mindset when you're in treatment during those first few times?
Yeah, the first few times I didn't want to be there at all. I wasn't doing it for me. I was just doing it to pacify my family, my parents, because I kind of felt bad that I was putting them through all this stuff, and I didn't want to do drugs anymore, but I hadn't made the decision that I was going to stop yet.
Right. And that's what's really interesting, right? Like, you're getting exposed to the solution on some level, right? Whatever the modality of the treatment center you're in, you're getting exposed to the tools and the solution, but you're just not in a place of willingness to work what they're giving you.
Right. I had absolutely no willingness at that point.
So while you're in treatment, you're just planning on when you get out, how you're going to get high.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly what was happening. I remember this one time when I went to a rehab in San Antonio. I was there in a sober living for 9 months straight. And the insanity of it is I had one bottle of Xanax with one little Xanax in it. And I hid it before I left. And I was just fantasizing on like exactly when I was going to take that pill, and I waited on it for 9 months. And the day that I left, I went and I took the pill, and then everything spun out of control again.
Right. So there's no real point. Is there a point in all the treatments where you start to go, oh, maybe I need to, but I can't? Like, does there start to get a little bit of willingness in within you, but you're unable to stop?
Yeah, I would say that was the second to the last time whenever I went into treatment was whenever I had that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I just, everything just got really scary really quick because the second to the last time when I went to rehab, prior to going into that rehab facility, I was at my parents' house and I shot up heroin. And I overdosed. It wasn't intentional. They found me on the floor of their bathroom face down. I was blue. They called the EMS, Narcan'd me. I woke up and looked at the EMS people and I said, get me the hell out of here. Like, I don't want to be here because the face on my parent, the look on my parents' face was just so scary. They're so disappointed and so terrified that I was like, I told them I wanted to kill myself. So they'd put me in a psych ward because I didn't trust myself anymore at that point. So,
yeah. So it's like seeing your parents' face mirrored back to you, the thing that you couldn't see up to that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I feel like that point was what really jarred me into saying like, okay, this is serious. You need to change because you're about to lose your family. Like, they already don't trust you. They love you, but you're about to lose everything. And so I went into the psych ward, and after that I started calling sober living houses and rehabs and all this stuff. And I got into a state-funded facility. Prior to the state-funded facility, I was going to some rehabs that were like resorts that were really, really nice. it was like going on vacation for me. I loved it. It's twisted, but I looked forward to it. And this last time I was in a state funded facility where I was sharing a bathroom with like 15 other women and was in a bedroom that was like really tiny with 3 bunk beds in it. Mm.
And this was the last one, the last treatment center you were in?
It was the second to last.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I was doing really, really well. And then one day, whenever I was in sober living, I happened to run into my drug dealer at the store and convinced him to drop off some heroin. And then I overdosed in that in the sober living house, which was insane. And then the next time, it was the last time that I went into rehab.
Now, every time you went into treatment and you get, you know, enough time away from the last drug use and you're feeling sober, does this sensory overload thing come back?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, for sure.
When did
it comes back even worse for a really long time because it's like a rebound effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So when do you start to look at that as a gift and not as a curse? When's the first time you started to think maybe this is for to help or to be of service or to be connected to God and others?
Yeah, I would say that it was probably about 6 months into my sobriety. And the reason why that was because it was the beginning of the pandemic. And since we couldn't go outside, I was forced to go within myself. Mm. And I started to meditate and to pray and learn more about God. And I was just doing a lot of studying and a lot of reading. I felt like I was downloading like so much information from books and YouTube and spiritual people and the Bible and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So
this last time at treatment, what would you say is the main difference, right? Like, what was the thing that was different about this treatment, this attempt? Because at this point, you're 2.5 years clean, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So with now that you have 2.5 years, right? But so that's a good stretch. What was it that was different about this time that was not the same in those last 11?
The last rehab that I went to wasn't the first time I had been to that location or to that rehab. And I really started to listen to what the technicians had to say to me and what my counselors had to say. And what I started to recognize is like the repetition in what people would say. And I started to realize that it was me that needed to change and that I was focusing all my energy on what other people needed to do. But I was finally able somehow to see clearly that I was the person that was the problem the entire time.
Mm, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a very humbling realization, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was probably crying in rehab for the first month, like on and off and on and off.
Yeah.
It was, I felt like I was dying. It was scary.
Yeah. Now, when we did the pre-interview, we talked a little bit about your faith, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so tell me about that, right? Because you're a Christian, self-professed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying you are. You told me you were. And
yes.
I'm just repeating it.
Right, right.
I'm not prophesizing you right here on the show. But so when did that happen?
Well, the last rehab that I went to, they took us to a church. On Sundays, we had the option to either go to church or to stick around the house and do chores, right? Well, first, my intention was to get the heck out of the house. I didn't want to have anything to do with church whatsoever. But this church, I just felt like God was speaking to me through this pastor. He had just such an amazing presence, and I was able to connect with what he was saying. And I just realized that all of the praying that my family's been doing the past couple of years in my addiction, and the praying that I was doing, and all of this, it just started to come together. I don't know. I just, I started to learn about Jesus in the church, and I started to read the word, and I didn't realize how powerful his word was. And I started to go to church twice a week. And because of that, I ended up getting baptized and everything. And yeah.
Yeah. Did they dunk you twice just to make sure?
Just to make sure.
Just to make sure it took, you know? So were you going to Joel Osteen's? Because I know you're like in Texas. So isn't that where Joel Osteen is?
Joel Osteen is actually in Houston. And okay. I was in Austin at the time. Okay, so I was going to, yeah, a different church.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. Because you said he was like a magnetic pastor. I thought maybe it was Joel
Osteen. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you're getting exposed to the gospel and to the teachings of Jesus in a way that's resonating with you. And
right.
And then the Spirit kind of takes over and begins revealing itself through the word, and you make the decision to become baptized. So, but before that, you had no, what was your idea of or relationship to God, you know, before that?
Yeah, my relationship with God and what I was taught growing up was that God was a damning and punishing God. And the churches that I used to go to prior used to tell me like, I'm going to go to hell and stuff like that. I was scared of God. Mm. I was so terrified.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like I was worthy of his love.
Yeah. And so something about this being exposed to the teaching in the way that you were at this church gave you a new example or metaphor or view of God. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It really did. And then I started to go to these groups called Freedom Group. And what they did was teach us how to let go of resentments and fears and judgment. And we started to learn about spiritual gifts. And then I started to realize that being an empath was a gift and it wasn't a curse, and that I could utilize that to help other people.
Yeah. So in addition to this spiritual awakening that you have and the spiritual experience and transformation, what else do you do currently to stay in recovery and to stay sober?
Mm-hmm. Well, every Thursday night, I take a meeting, a 12-step meeting to a men's sober living house. The reason why it's a men's sober living is because my friend runs the sober living house. So I go over there. Sometimes I'll tell my story, but most of the time I'll bring somebody else with me. And if it's not a speaker meeting, we'll just have like a general meeting, just talk about how the week's been going. We'll do some step studies and things like that. I have my YouTube channel. So what I like to do on there is to read the daily reflections. For the month of January, we go over the first step, February, the second step. I just like to tell my story on there, whatever it is that God wants to say through me that day. Sometimes I'll just go off the cuff and record whatever it is that God wants me to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're part of a 12 step fellowship.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I go to meetings every single day.
Yeah.
Till this day.
You're practicing the 12 steps. What was it about the steps? You know, what in the steps has helped you the most?
I would say it's the third step, surrendering my will and life over to the care of God as I understand him. That was the biggest step for me. Because for me, what I've learned is that when I experience agitation or doubt, that it's just a sign that I'm in self-will. So one of the most important things that I did for the first year of my sobriety is whenever I noticed that agitation and doubt, my sponsor, he taught me to just ask God to direct my thinking. So I kind of felt like silly because I would say, God, direct my thinking probably like hundreds of times a day because I would notice that agitation and doubt popping up for me.
Yeah.
And so surrendering my will and life over to the care of God has been like the key to my sobriety and staying serene.
Yeah. Now, and that's true, right? The concept of surrender, the concept of handing your will and your life over, it's so powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think what for me, my experience with that step is it continues to give life, you know, and it continues to deepen the longer that I keep surrendering, you know. And sometimes mm-hmm. I'm like, boy, you want me to surrender more? Like, come on.
Yes.
But it's so it's scary sometimes.
It is.
Because what I'm really saying is, God, I know better than you, right? Mm-hmm. And you, I gave you all that. You still want more, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So now what about the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth and the seventh step? Did mm-hmm. you have you done those? And what was that experience like for you?
Oh, yeah. I've done all the steps. And the funny thing is, whenever I came into the rooms, I thought I'm going to just do it one and I'll be done. Mm. I thought I was going to graduate, get a certificate and be like, okay, I don't have to ever do the steps again. But it's something that I continue to do on a daily basis. I don't know how many times I've been through them, maybe like four times or something like that.
Yeah.
The fourth step, when I first came into the rooms and saw the steps on the wall, I was really terrified, because the last thing I wanted to do was to look at my fears and my resentments and take responsibility mm. for everything that had gone on in 25 years of alcoholism and addiction. Mm.
Right. Yeah. Who cares to do that? Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now tell me about from the first time you did the step four and step mm-hmm. five. And for those who aren't familiar, step four is a fearless moral inventory. And step five is essentially taking that moral inventory and sharing it with another person and with God. So this first time that you go through four and five, tell me about that experience and tell the listeners about that experience. What was that like for you and what did you get out of it?
You know, I procrastinated a lot on making the list of my resentments and my fears, because my subconscious mind kept telling me, oh, you don't need to do this. You can stay sober if you don't do this and all that stuff. But eventually I just wrote everything down and I met with my sponsor. And the way that he had me do this step work was just so amazing, because I would just put, like, for example, like my fear was, I don't know, working. And honestly, that was one of the biggest fears, because I did not like to do anything. I like to have the easy way out. So I would look at the root cause of my fear. Why I don't work? Well, I think that if I work, then I don't know, I'll be tired or something like that. It's hard to explain the way that we did it, but he was able to explain it in such a way that I was able to see my responsibility in all of it. And not only that, just to how to turn it around so that I would not allow it to hold me down for the rest of my life.
Yeah. So this thing that you were kind of fearful of and procrastinating on and then doing mm-hmm. it was a pathway to freedom for you.
It was really a pathway to freedom. And I felt like the more, so once I put this stuff down on paper, like that was important. But the most cathartic thing for me was to hear myself say these things that I was fearful over and the things that I had resentments over. Mm. And that felt like, I literally felt like weight was being lifted off of me as like we were speaking. Mm. I felt like I was letting down this backpack full of bricks or whatever.
Yeah.
And so part of, like, I'd say 90% of me just wanted to continue like going on and telling them about all these fears and resentments, because I started to feel better about it. And I knew that going down the path that I was going before, like, it wasn't working. So,
yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it was better than the pain of what the old way would have been. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've gone through the steps, you're doing the steps, you've went to treatment. I imagine you're involved in some sort of local church or something, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I am.
Yeah. And so what do you have now today that you never mm-hmm. thought was possible for you to have?
The first thing that really comes to mind is the trust of my parents. Like, I feel like I'm going to tear up right now, because I can actually like look them in the eye and they can trust me. They know that the words that are coming out of my mouth is nothing but complete honesty. And one of the things that I've learned in my sobriety is to be impeccable with my word, which means without sin. So I'm very, very mindful of what I say when I talk to people. And so my parents can see the change. And that is something that I never thought would come back, because I had lied and manipulated and stolen and everything from them for so many years that I didn't know that it would be possible to have this unconditional love and support and trust. And it is.
Wow. That's a beautiful thing mm-hmm. to have returned. What mm-hmm. else? What else is there that's returned?
I have an amazing relationship with my brothers, and I have one brother that's a year younger than me and one that's 7. So they've seen me go through all of this stuff. And so that's really awesome. And just to be able to have my family back and to be present for my nieces that are growing up, 1, 7, 8, and 9 years old. So it's just good to be able to be part of their life and not have to be like at a family function thinking like, oh my gosh, I need to go shoot up, or I need a pill, or I need some alcohol or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
But I would say, like, as far as the material things that I'm happy to have is this apartment that I'm sitting in right now.
Yeah.
Because I lived in sober living homes, or renting like a bedroom from somebody in Austin for so, so long. And now I can just be here with myself, and I don't feel like I'm constantly needing to do something. Mm. I'm okay being in silence. I'm okay being with my thoughts. And I also have this new YouTube studio that I'm about to set up too. And I feel like that's something that God really wants me to do, is just share my story, because without Him, I wouldn't be here today.
Yeah. Amen. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. So what we like to end with is final thoughts. Mm-hmm. And so for this segment, it's essentially, you know, it's words to the person who's out there who might still be stuck in their addiction, or maybe they're completely unhappy in recovery. I don't know. But the person that's listening, right? What do you have to say to that person? What can you share with them to give them some hope and to let them know that you understand?
Yeah. You know, what I like to say is that I was an addict, an alcoholic for 25 years. I've done all the drugs under the sun, and in the end, you know, I had sold the keys to my apartment to a drug dealer. At one point, I was stuck in a wheelchair. I had also lost the ability to speak, and it was because of nothing physical, but I was just so terrified because the drugs and alcohol in the end just stopped working. I tried doctors, therapists, psychiatrists, prescription medications to try to get off drugs, and nothing worked. The only thing that worked for me was the 12-step program, because it guided me to a higher power that's greater than myself, that did restore me to sanity. And I never thought that I could be sane again. And I don't know, if you have just the tiny bit of willingness, and it maybe if you don't have any willingness at all, the thing that helped me was to pray for the willingness to be willing. And I didn't even know who I was praying to, but my sponsor said, pray for the willingness to be willing. And eventually I became willing to try these steps. And my life has changed in such a way that it's honestly like hard to put into words, but there is hope. And please reach out if you have any questions.
Yeah. I love it. That's beautifully said. Well said. And thank you so much for sitting in the seat of service and sharing your story, your experience, and being so raw and open and transparent about it. And, you know, I'm sure this is just the first of many collaborations, and we'll be looking for your content coming out. And this has been brought to you by the makers of the letter B, the Most High Show. You never heard that? The Most High Show is brought to you by sponsors and people who donate to make this thing happen. And it's amazing and it's humbling to have people put their hard-earned money towards this nonprofit organization so that we can share stories like this. And we still need help to keep doing this. So I want to thank everyone who's donated. I want to thank Michelle for sharing your story so authentically. And thank my main man, Jeff, on the ones and twos. We'll be back next week. This has been The Most High Show.